Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and get a unique WordPress website or store right away. From there, you can customize your design, colors, and content. And Bluehost automatically helps you get found in search engines like Google and Bing. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins, Bluehost makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Go to Bluehost.com/WonderSuite.
Hey everyone, I'm Ian DeBorja, and welcome to IMDb's first episode of Movies That Changed My Life, a podcast where your favorite stars break down the films that made them who they are today. This week's guest, our first guest ever actually, is actor Jeffrey Wright. You may know him as Bernard from HBO's Westworld, and you may be looking forward to seeing him as Jim Gordon alongside Robert Pattinson in The Batman. Really quickly about The Batman, you obviously can't say much about it at all, but what was it like when you got to book Jim Gordon?
I had been a huge Batman fan as a kid, but it was, you know, it was the Adam West version. You know, that was the intro for me. But I was a nut for that. You know, when that came out in the late 60s, you know, I was, what, first grade, second grade in 1972. So after school in D.C. on, what was it, WDCA, Channel 20, Adam West Batman, every afternoon, bro. Every afternoon. Preceded by Ultraman. Ultraman and Batman.
Ultraman.
1-2 punch, baby. Oh, dude, I was there, like, at the altar.
That big silver and red suit.
Oh, man. Oh, come on. So, you know, and Matt, actually, we talked about that when we were kids, Matt's around the same age I am, you know, we didn't see those, you know, those early, you know, that early series as being camp, you know?
Right.
That was serious business, man. That was Batman and, you know, high tech, serious stuff. But no, I was a massive fan of that show. And that show really kind of like owed itself, you know, in terms of like the pastels and the, and
right,
you know, the tone of it, you know, to the original, you know, to the original DC Comics in 1939, those types of tones, you know. So that's, you know, not where we're necessarily grounded with this one, but yeah, I'm really stoked to be a part of it, and also to kind of look back and look at the history of this and see the way that it's evolved and see, you know, explore why it's lasted, you know, these stories for, you know, for 80 years and 90 years, right? What, 69, 67, 80 years. It's been a fun exploration. Yeah. So Matt, you know, we went and we met and then, you know, called back and said, "Hey, want you to do this. Would you, be Gordon?" And I'm like, "Yeah, man, let's go." And so when we started filming, really some pre-shooting, you know, early scenes, like January 4th or 5th. And then we got going in earnest about 2 weeks later, and we were cranking, man. We were just getting after it. And I was really, really liking what we were doing. You know, we saw Matt, like, kind of post up a few little
gems teases on there. Twitter and Instagram. You know,
yeah, just blowing the thing. Boom! We'd be on set, right? And I'm like, oh, shit. Wow, man. I mean, literally, we're in the middle of filming. Boom! And then it's like, you know, there's, you know, Robert and, you know, like, yeah, killing it in the suit. And then, you know, the Batmobile, I was like, those shots. I was like, ah, yeah, because when I read the script, the Batmobile was described in a very specific way. And I said, man, that is right on the money. The Batmobile, okay, where does that come from? What is it? And I love the idea, as you saw, that it's grounded in a real kind of American truth, you know, a hardcore, hyper-hemified muscle car, like hyped up to the max that, you know, he built, he spent a shitload of money on, and he put out there on the street, and it's not going to be messed with, baby, you know, but it's something, okay, I get that. I know where that is. And it grounds us. It's still like kind of hyper-realistic. But at the same time, it's Gotham, because, you know, the thing about Batman is that, you know, he doesn't have superpowers, you know, so he is grounded in, in a city that kind of looks a lot like the city that I live in, or Chicago, or, you know, we know that this is Gotham. Gotham, we know, is in America. So how do we play with that and root it in things that we can touch, but at the same time, give it, you know, all of the beauty and the scale and the melancholy and the sense of adventure and wonder that, you know, that you want from these films.
Well, I know people will patiently wait for The Batman, which got pushed to a 2021 release date, but at least it's something for fans to look forward to when all this craziness ends. But now let's go ahead and jump into your first pick for movies that changed your life, which is 1986's Sid and Nancy, which tells the story of Sid Vicious, bassist of the band The Sex Pistols, and his girlfriend, Nancy Spungen. The movie was directed by Alex Cox and stars the great Gary Oldman and Chloe Webb. It has a 7.0 and 28,000 ratings on IMDb. So set the scene for us. When was the first time you watched Sid and Nancy?
You know, I'm trying to remember, actually, because I haven't seen it in a while. I hadn't seen it in a while until last night. I rewatched it, you know, because when I'm faced with this question, a movie that changed my life, you know, I was like, that's kind of a tough one, you know, changed my life. And then, you know, I thought about it in some very specific ways in which it has influenced my life and my work as an actor, particularly. And I was trying to figure out where I saw it, and I believe it was with some friends of mine, some movie buff friends of mine, roommates of mine from college. Hello, Randy. And I believe Hat was there, but you know, hello, you guys. And I think we were in Boston, I believe, for whatever reason, and we went to see this movie. And I had started acting in 1986, late 86. I was, you know, in college, but I was a political science major. I wasn't really, you know, kind of doing much. I had always been in love with the theater, and since the time I was a kid, you know, going to plays with my mom, and I'd always kind of thought about it, but I never really did anything about it until 1986. I was a junior in college. And it just bit into me, and here we are. So saw this film, and it's funny because I hadn't seen it, but I'm watching the film last night, and it's so vivid to me. You know, moments were so vivid, and I was like, okay, here come, and I think I've probably only seen it twice. The first time, maybe three times, maybe there was another time. But the reason that it hit me was, yeah, because I was just starting acting, and I saw this guy, Gary Oldman, you know? And I was like, holy, whoa, man, what's that dude doing? You know, Chloe Webb as well was, you know,
fantastic.
Just, you know, like over the top, like just brilliant. And Gary just like, man, I looked at that. I was like, oh, dude, this dude is getting after it.
I can't find it. My Action Man.
You mean G.I. Joe.
I didn't even hear 5 minutes ago. I haven't seen since I was a kid. It's very malleable. I want to kill.
Wait, flying in. Tell him to Oh, no.
And, you know, as far as actors go, there have been many actors who have influenced me. Of course, But Gary's influence on me was in very specific ways. And so, you know, to follow him doing, you know, having, you know, his having done Gordon, to, you know, do it now, for, you know, for my, you know, for follow him and for me to do it now is really cool. But yeah, early on, that movie hit me in a way that, as I think back, really, you know, changed some things for me.
Yeah, Gary Oldman, I mean, in my notes when I watched it the other day too, I mean, you just get lost in every character Gary Oldman plays.
Yeah.
Like, he is a completely transformative actor in every role he does, and he is so, so good in this. Mm-hmm. And again, Chloe Webb is equally as fantastic mm-hmm. As Nancy. And obviously Gary, you know, he has this huge career and he gets so much praise for his role as Sid Vicious. But I really think Chloe is just on par with him there too throughout this whole thing.
It's no question.
Mm-hmm. Were you into the punk scene at all growing up? Did you like punk music and were you into that? Or is that a part of the reason why this movie struck with you as well?
No, I wouldn't say I was like a full-on punk. I mean, I listen to every type of music, you know? That's not what drew me so much to it. But of course, it did in the sense that edge, you know, we were all, you know, kids that age, you know, you're for the most part, drawn to that type of edge. So, yeah, that, you know, that had something to do with it, too. Also, you know, it's London, but it's also New York, you know, it's like, you know, it's kind of, you know, not specifically, but it was that village scene, New York, even though a lot of it takes place in the Chelsea Hotel. You know, that was, you know, that New York was kind of calling me a bit too. You know, Spike Lee's movie was around that time. She's Got to Have It. That was another one that was kind of like, you know, New York calling. You know, it was another, you know, movie, if I think back to like Midnight Cowboy, you know, it was another kind of, you know, underside of New York, you know, these kind of scenes that I was getting. And then, boom, it was, you know, Sid and Nancy was, you know, was another kind of strange invitation to the, you know, to New York. And when I first moved here, I ended up living, you know, I lived on 10th and D on the Lower East Side. That was my first place before I began school at NYU grad school. That was 1988. So, you know, right, you know, yeah, about 10 years after the end of the Sid and Nancy story, but still that vibe, you know, there's that bit of that vibe around. So, that, you know, that was part of the appeal and part of why we chose to go see it. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, the whole movie felt like, it felt like a fantasy, almost like a messed up fairy tale. Like there's so many instances where you're like, is this how it happened? This is how Sid saw it happen. Like there's a scene where the Sex Pistols are having a party on the boat and then the cops come and arrest everyone. But Sid and Nancy just like walk off arm in arm, sort of laughing, like walking away. I mean, there's so many of these cool like fantasies there and things like that struck me as like this really bizarre fairy tale of like star-crossed lovers in a sort of way.
Oh, totally. It's so much is a fairy tale. And I'm not sure they're star-crossed. I mean, they're, you know, what's fascinating about the movie is in the midst of all of this, in the midst of all of their dysfunction, all of their pain, all of their confusion, chaos, there's like kind of like an undeniable real love there, you know? And that scene, you know, when they're, you know, and it is as well fantastical, the, you know, the cinematography by Roger Dinkins, you know, there are moments of just like, you know, like kind of like stained glass, you know, cathedral stained glass, like, you know, light and wonder. But what you're looking at is the two of them in an alley with garbage like raining down and they're kissing. And it's like the most beautiful moment. This, like, it's like it's awful and it is absolutely gorgeous. And all of a sudden the screen that, you know, that, you know, that music comes under and all of a sudden the screen just breathes, you know, just like exhales. And it's like, whoa, I mean, it's real. So, yeah, it is a fairy tale and it is very much subjective. But at the same time, you know, it's fitting, too, because, you know, those brains were, they were seeing things. They were seeing things with the assistance of certain chemicals, and they were not seeing things too. But it is a kind of horrible, beautiful, lovely fairy tale.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you talk about Roger Deakins. I mean, the great Roger Deakins, legendary cinematographer. This is relatively very early in his career.
Yeah.
I read that he wanted to shoot it in black and white, but, you know, the studio said they didn't want to do that. It'd be too artsy. So instead, Deakins sort of, I guess, throughout the film, he started, like, pulling out less and less color from the shots. So there's less posters in color. There's less clothes in color, just to slowly get it, like, more dreary. And yeah, that shot you're talking about of them kissing in the alleyways. I mean, it's fantastic. It's amazing.
Yeah, I'm glad he didn't shoot in black and white. Those just those kind of muted colors serve it. You know, they kind of everything's just a little bit drained of its blood, and because of that, the palette just has a it has a softness to it. You know, the tones just have. They're intoxicating and intoxicated in a way that makes perfect sense. So I think he did it just right. You know, I think the studio might have directed him in a reasonably constructive way, which is not entirely the case always. But Gary, just going back to why this movie, I think, is meaningful in ways related to him. Is that in terms of performance and also in some ways in terms of story, you know, I think for me, I can draw a direct line from seeing this film to Basquiat, where I, you know, interact or intercept for the first time, Gary, you know, it's the first time we worked together. And, two stories that have obvious similarities in terms, in many ways, you know, both stories of, you know, artists on the outside of most circles, struggling to kind of be on the inside or not. Mm-hmm. And both, you know, with an edge to them, obviously. Both died tragically young, but, you know, a lot of it set in, you know, lower Manhattan, too. So, there's a lot of parallels there. But in terms of, like, kind of performance, like, when I saw that movie, I think that was, for me, I guess, what a lot of actors of kind of James Dean's generation saw when they saw him for the first time. It was like, you know, I got permission, you know? It's like, oh, wow, okay, I can go there, you know? So Gary was like kind of an invitation, a permission to be really personal and to be as, you know, extreme and full emotionally as is, you know, is necessary, as you want, as fits the character and the story. And that was a big deal, man, because I hadn't seen anybody do what he was doing, right? Really, I hadn't seen there's nobody playing those notes, man. There's nobody like going there, you know, come on, man. It's like, what? Oh, wow, okay. So yeah, that was, you know, it was a several doors opening, you know, and then as well, like, you know, another movie that I did early on, shortly after Basquiat, was Shaft. Different story, different genre, obviously, but that, you know, the character that I played, you know, goes to some places, you know, and that again was like, you know, Gary, yeah, okay, we're free to do this, you know, we're free to really bring it. And so, yeah, man, he early on in kind of ways unrelated to, you know, a personal thing, you know, had influenced me. And then when I met him and we got to work together, it was just boom, you know,
yep.
You know, we just hit it, you know, and like every other actor in there who were, who all were folks that I admired. I mean, David Bowie, come on, yeah. You know, massive, massive, massive influence on me. I mean, from early on, and then now as a young actor, a young artist, you know, at the beginning of my thing, boom, here he is, like kind of welcoming. It's like, wow. But, you know, his music forever had been, you know, like a score in my, you know, at times in my head. So you know, Chris Walken was there. These were other actors too, who like Gary, you know, kind of, you know, push the edge, you know, Dennis Hopper. I mean, Dennis, you know,
who we'll talk about, you know, Dennis Hopper in a little
we'll
bit.
Catch up with in our next film. But, you know, Dennis, you know, those were other artists, you know, and I think we all recognize that, you know, when we were there, those were all artists who, like, there was, you know, enjoyed a kinship between one another, you know, and, you know, and here I was, you know, and, you know, being welcome inside that. It was pretty cool. It was pretty cool. And I'll never forget the first scene we filmed. On that movie was a scene in which Jean-Michel walks into a restaurant and he presents these postcards that he wants to sell to Warhol, to Bowie, and Bruno Bischofberger, Dennis Hopper's there. And that was the first scene that we shot. Benicio, another great actor, obviously. Benicio and I are outside. Look, let's, you know, point. Hey, I'm going in there. Go in. Boom. So we shot the interior of that scene first. The first, literally first scene of that shoot. And so we go in. We rehearse it. I go back to my, back to makeup or whatever to get the thing. And I'm sitting there, and Dennis walks in. He opens the door, walks in the trailer, and he leans into my ear, and he says, "Cool." And I was like, "Oh man, okay, let's roll." I was like, you know, I didn't. That was all I needed to hear. Yeah. So yeah. So and but you know, but yeah. So to so my being there. You know, there were many things that brought me there, but definitely that film, Sid and Nancy, and what Gary had done allowed me to, in some ways, find a way to get there, to be able to, you know, inhabit some of those spaces because, you know, he had shown me something about how to get there.
Awesome.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So let's talk Westworld a little bit. I think the comments we'd receive for talking to you on this podcast and not talking about Westworld would be brutal. So we got to talk about it. I've been a huge fan of Westworld since season one. What do you think the cast and crew and Lisa Joy and Nolan, they've learned from, you know, season one to season two to season three?
What have we learned? I think we learn a lot. Jonah and Lisa have a fairly far-reaching narrative arc in their heads. So they're just, you know, moving the ball down the field toward that end. And obviously the show this year is in some ways a departure from previous years, but in other ways it's not. The show has always been about kind of flipping the body inside out and showing the refractions and reflections and, you know, projecting those into the mirror, you know, whether it's on an individual case, whether it's in terms of timelines, whether it's in terms of kind of the ways narratives weave into one another and kind of become something else. And this year, in terms of the park that we inhabit, which is the park that looks very much like the park outside of our doors, and in these days feels even more like that. So the show has been kind of reborn in some ways, but continuing on the same path in other ways. But that path, of course, has many trails, you know, that shoot off of it. So it's more Westworld. I guess it's a little more, slightly more in some ways, perhaps linear than it has been in the past, but maybe it is, maybe it isn't. You never know.
That's right.
but it's been fun. It's been a fun ride, fun 3 years. We just got picked up to do it again. So
yeah, for season four.
Yeah. Yeah. We love the show. We love working with one another, you know, and so we get after it again.
So much fun of watching Westworld is the infinite amount of fan theories, the Reddit comments, the Twitter threads, all that sorts of stuff. Do you participate in those? Do you ever like kind of read just to see what's going on there? Or do you like keeping that part a little bit separate from your everyday life?
No, I did. I totally did. Particularly the first season, you know, because it was great for me. It was almost as though fans were co-writers in the writer's room, because they were going off on their own narrative journeys. And in some ways, I really say, okay, that's as valid as anything else. Some were maybe less valid than others, but it's as a means, as like kind of a creative, a creative tangent to the show. Certainly meaningful, valuable, and it was cool. I was digging it, and I wanted to find out, how far ahead we were, or were we lagging behind the audience's brain? And so, I check it out less so now. I'm been busy.
Yeah.
So I haven't had a chance lately to see where folks are, but yeah, I think it's super cool.
Hey everyone, I hope you're enjoying the first episode of Movies That Changed My Life. If you are, please hit that subscribe button to make sure you get all of our upcoming episodes as soon as they're available. And if you would be so kind, please leave a review and let us know what you think of the show so far. We have some great guests lined up for future episodes, including Joel McHale from Community, The Tiger King and I, and The CW Stargirl, Archer, Arrested Development, and Valley Girls' Judy Greer, and dear friend of IMDb, Silent Bob himself, Kevin Smith. Last, you can also check out imdb.com/podcast for more content. All right, let's get back to Movies That Changed My Life with Jeffrey Wright. All right, next movie, Apocalypse Now, 1979, directed by the legendary Francis Ford Coppola, starring Martin Sheen, Marlon Brando, Robert Duvall, Harrison Ford, Dennis Hopper, Lawrence Fishburne, among many others, about a U.S. Army officer. A
couple actors.
Yeah, just a few small names. You might have heard of them. U.S. Army officer serving Vietnam is tasked with assassinating a renegade special forces colonel who sees himself as a god. Set the scene for this one.
Oh, man. When I first saw Apocalypse Now, it was after it had come out in the theaters. And there were, a couple of friends of mine in high school who were like huge on war movies. And one of them actually ended up in the military. He was an officer in a tank unit and an armored unit in the first Gulf War. Bill Delaney. Hello, Bill. And he and another friend of mine who I went to high school with and also to college with, a guy named Steve Phillips, loved this movie. And I think it was, maybe 80. It was a couple of years after it came out, It was such an immersive experience. Like, it was, you turn that movie on, and I'm sure we all have movies like this, and it just transported me. I was inside that place, and I was, the room got warm and, you know, humid, and, you know, it almost, you know, it just has a, you know, an odor to it at times, even, yeah. You know, whether it be like, you know, of a mango tree or of, you know, of something, you know, something grimmer, you know. And
the fresh smell of napalm.
Yeah, you know, in the morning, as it said, you know, and it just took me on this journey, you know, immersive journey, and the kind of literary quality of it, you know, was just so powerful. Obviously, it's based on Heart of Darkness, Joseph Conrad's novel, which is actually set in the Congo. The film was, you know, filled with this kind of literary quality to it, and the imagery to that you know that is created by that because of the narration and the language, let alone the imagery and, you know, the performances. But it just had, it was just full with all of this stuff. It's a film that I can't see the likes of which ever being made again.
Yeah.
I mean, what, 2 years? However long it took them to make that film out in the Philippines, or wherever they were, you know, calling in the Philippine army, you know, for the Philippine Air Force to fly over them. I mean, you know, that shit ain't happening no more, man. That ain't, you know, those days are gone, man. You know, and you have, you know, this just like at very least temporarily mad genius at the center of it, Francis Ford Coppola, like kind of choreographing all of this stuff in a way that creates something that is dense and exciting and singular and just like, for me, for, you know, a kid, I don't know, you know, 17, 18, whatever it was, you know, like, whoa, I mean, it was hitting all the notes. It was hitting all the stuff for me. And definitely in terms of, you know, as I, you know, started, you know, becoming more interested in, you know, in acting, I became even more immersed in it. I've probably seen that film, unlike Sid and Nancy, I've probably seen that film over 100 times. I don't remember the last time I seen it, but it was like a period where it was just like my thing, you know? It was like, okay, Saigon, you know, that was where it began and part of where it took me.
Part of the legend of this movie is all the things that it took to get this movie made. I mean, all these stories of shooting on the set. Something that I really love and come to is that when Marlon Brando showed up, he was, you know, pretty overweight. And so that forced Francis Ford Coppola to only shoot his face and put him in shadows. But like, that is what makes Kurtz so freaking good.
Yeah, man.
Like, Kurtz is like this monster when you're introduced to him. The way, like, he's rubbing water on his head and the lights are just showing. I mean, it's unbelievable. And the reason that happens...
Eating pistachios or anything.
Yeah, the reason that happens is because he was a little bit overweight. Coppola didn't want to show him like that. And it's like, I mean, it's amazing. Is there a specific performance you, like, really are drawn to when you think of this movie? I mean, I know it's so hard.
Nope. I mean, it's Sheen... It's, you know, it's Harrison Ford in that little, you know, moment with the officers. There's the dude who says, you know, who's sitting with the, you know, the bangs, the sweaty bangs, you know, exterminate with extreme prejudice. You know, I mean, there's like, you know, you try this, this shrimp.
Captain, I don't know how you feel about this shrimp, but... If you'll eat it, you'll never have to prove your courage in any other way.
And I can assure you, you'll never have to prove your courage in any other way. I mean, it's just like every moment of this film is a masterpiece portrait in and of itself. But if there is one that I will single out, and I'll single it out for a very specific reason, and that is Albert Hall, right? Who plays Chief. So... Chief, who, you know, it might have been my mission, but it sure as hell was the Chief's boat, you know? And so Albert Hall and I crossed paths in the first film role that I ever did, which was a miniseries called Separate But Equal, in which I played the youngest of the lawyers who worked at the NCAA Legal Defense Fund in arguing the Brown versus Board of Education case at the Supreme Court. And Sidney Poitier played Thurgood Marshall. And Albert Hall, he was on this team. And I'm like, I show up. I'm like, Sidney Poitier. Oh, man. Yeah, Cleavon Little. Yeah, yeah. But, whoa, Albert Hall. Like, Chief. And I'm like, oh, man. Oh, bro. And so at one point, I think it was at the end of this. And I guess when I was down there for a couple of months down in South Carolina working on this film, my first ever film, my first ever single shot, you know, was opposite Sidney Poitier. And I'm like 22 years old. And I got the gig, or I got the audition at the time, because I had a political science degree, you know? So the casting director said, send this knucklehead here, you know? And I'd been acting like for like 3 days, man, right. You know? I just started like, just out of school. I'm like, huh? You know, I think my headshot might have been a passport photo or something. And I was like, At the end of the thing, you know, obviously spoke to Sidney about some things. But Albert came up to me. And he said, Jeffrey, he handed me a book. And the book was the autobiography of a yogi. And he wrote inside the book, it said, Jeffrey, someday there'll be a young actor. He said, someday there'll be a young actor who comes up to you and says, I've seen your film 100 times, and it has meaning to me. And he said, that will be an evolution. And that was what he'd written on the inside of the cover of the book. And so, yeah.
I mean, that's really amazing to hear. So if you're able to draw a through line between Sid and Nancy and Apocalypse Now, do you think there would be one?
So when I talk about these films, because of the impact that they had on me, but also because of the personal connections that were related to them in my career, particularly early on, that really shaped the things that I've been up to.
Thank you for helping kick off this podcast with two pretty incredible movie selections. If you haven't seen Sid and Nancy or Apocalypse Now, you should go check that out right away. But before we go, I did want to make sure that we had a chance to talk about Brooklyn for Life and all the great work you're doing to support the frontline workers over in Brooklyn.
I put together an organization with some friends of mine here in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, called Brooklyn for Life. We're now providing 2,500 meals per day on average to local hospitals, seven, now eight medical facilities in Brooklyn, one in Lower Manhattan that snuck in because everybody wants to be in Brooklyn, so we'll take them. And all 11 FDNY EMS stations here in Brooklyn. We're doing that through a rotation of 42 small biz restaurants here. So we started March 27th with two restaurants delivering 200 meals to Brooklyn Hospital, which, if I look out my window, is just across the way there. So we've been hustling on that since March 27th. Set up a GoFundMe page March 25th, set up a 501c3 shortly thereafter. So we've been receiving funds through the GoFundMe and also via direct donation to our 501c3. So that has kept me busy, kept me focused, kept the television off, kept me my frustrations and, you know, concerns and sense of helplessness to some extent in check. So it's been good. The restaurants are really engaged in this. They're feeling purposeful, and they're also doing something for their own employees and for the lives of their businesses. So that's been great. We put out a video. We released that Friday morning with a bunch of Brooklynites, known and unknown. That was really about a celebration of Brooklyn, a celebration of our love for our community. These were certain Brooklynites who were either born here, lived here at some point, or live here now. And so it was a really great gathering of people who came together to spread the love, you know, celebrating, our community and the cause that we're all facing as a collective. And also it was a call to action to help us raise some further funds to keep this operation going. Specifically, I'm hoping we can get some corporate support right now. We've had none. We've raised about $450,000, 70, I believe, the last I checked on the GoFundMe page, and then some other larger donations directly to the 501c3. Daniel Craig stepped in very early. Spike Lee, Jay-Z has contributed. So it's been kind of gratifying that we've had these, you know, big dollar donations, and we've also had an equal amount, you know, $5 and $10 donations, small dollar donations of people in the community and outside the community who just wanted to help. So, you know, we've all come together to see if we can, you know, if we can do something, you know, that's helpful in the midst of all this. So, you know, everyone has stepped up except some of our corporate neighbors. So, you know, I hope they receive that call to action too. Brooklyn for Life. You can go to brooklynforlife.org. You can see the video there. You can also, if you want, if you feel it, if you have it, you can chip in. But watch the video, share it, feel the vibe. And you can also go to our GoFundMe page, which is GoFundMe Brooklyn for Life, and you'll find us. Since March 27th, we've grown into 2,500 meals per day to all of these various sites, and we have surpassed I think 55,000 meals in total since then. So it's
amazing.
You know, it's been great to get some revenues flowing to these local small you know mom and pop joints. And you know, show some support and love, and provide some sustenance to folks who are dealing with this thing on the front lines. Brooklyn for Life, baby!
Thank you so much. This has been great. I love talking about all this stuff with you. It's like it's cool getting a very personal, like your personal history spin of like, yeah, like you love these movies, but it's also so much about how it affected your personal life and your acting career. It's fantastic. Where can people keep up with you again if you want to help out with Brooklyn for Life? See all the great work you're doing, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, you can go to brooklynforlife.org and you can check out the story there. And if you feel it, if you have it, you know, you can help us out, you know, with whatever you can. Or you can go to our GoFundMe page, which is Brooklyn for Life GoFundMe. Just do a Google search of that. But either way, you'll see our story. But you can check out the video at brooklynforlife.org and you know, check it out. Trying to spread a little love with some folks that you know, some folks that you don't know, all repping Brooklyn for Life.
Amazing. Well, Jeffrey, thank you so much. This was a ton of fun, and stay safe out there.
Cool.
Thank you again for all the great work you're doing for the frontline workers, and we'll talk to you soon.
You too, bro. All right, thanks, man.
Thank you.
All right, stay safe, y'all.